A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Maven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch. The lights are probably gone. So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 50. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are continuing our discussion of Artemis 81. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England, and 50 episodes. Congratulations, Brian. So yes, as you say, we're talking about Artemis 81, a strange 1981 BBC television film, 3 hours long, an unusual mixture of science fiction, of gothic horror, a detective story going on, and strange dialogue, which we're going to talk about in a moment.
It is something of a forgotten cult film. It was originally broadcast, as we said, in 1981 by the BBC, and has had very little in the way of broadcast after that. And no releases until this recent DVD that we've been looking at. It is a complex, intertwined story with lots of layers to it. It makes references and allusions and homage to the films of Alfred Hitchcock and to Scandinavian and Danish film, Ingmar Bergman and others. It makes reference to organ music of all things and more as well. So there is a lot going in here, and it is somewhat convoluted, and there's so much that it can be a little difficult to penetrate and understand at the beginning.
So let's try and piece together a few more bits and pieces of the bits we can, and we're going to get back to talking about the story of Artemis 81. And it's 3 hours long. The first 90 minutes after the unusual sort of introduction on an alien planet, the first 90 minutes pretty much seemed to take the form of a detective story, with Gideon Harlax, the writer played by Huel Bennett, investigating the various goings-on. And although it's rather slow, it does start out, I think, as a reasonable mystery story, a reasonable detective story, with him starting to pull various bits and pieces together, and we're trying to solve the mystery along with him.
It also has aspects of being a character drama at that point, where as Harlax is investigating, he grows and changes as a character, and things that he would not accept at the beginning of the story, he begins to accept as time goes on. So there are some interesting things to that piece of the story. We also have this idea of the pieces of a statue. At the beginning of the story, we're introduced to what seems to be a living statue on this alien planet, and then a regular small statue on Earth that we see, and it's a statue that is in five pieces, and it is very early stolen and taken on this North Sea ferry going from Denmark to England. And these pieces of the statue apparently have some connection to the alien world, and very early we get the idea that they have power to them.
That's right, and one of the powers that we sort of hinted at in the last episode, it seems to be that people who come into contact with a piece of this statue, something awful happens to them, and there are these sort of suicides that seems to link all the various characters in the story, and it's those suicides that Harlax is investigating, and he's travelling to the sites of these deaths, and he's investigating the families, and he's making complicated charts and trying to pull all the pieces together and solve the puzzle.
Some of that is quite dark. It's actually fairly grim.
It is. Yeah, it is. It's grim and nasty. You know, there's a scene very early on of a young family, and although none of it is graphic, it is certainly dark and grim and unpleasant. And then there's other clues dropped along the way. One that I noted was the strange blue flowers that seem to be appearing in various places. And Gideon Harlax and one of his friends, who's a film lecturer, notice these flowers at one point and are curious about them because they say it's the autumn and why are these new flowers appearing? And yet, although the camera dwells on them on a couple of occasions, I think it's like it's one of those clues that's never really solved for us. It never really sort of pays off. I don't know if you spotted what it was all about, Brian, but I couldn't work that one out.
the meaning of the blue flowers is not entirely clear, is it?
No, although it does seem to be significant because, we do see them in several places connected to these suicides that Gideon's investigating. But there's also other clues in, more typical detective fashion along the way that he's going to look into.
The flowers may be related to the fact that we have Magog as part of this as a fertility symbol, so the new flowers may be related to that. But I'm guessing. It isn't clear to me that that's the case.
No.
We also get clues in the manuscript for some organ music. There is a sequence where Gwen, who is a student of the organ, visits this elderly organ virtuoso, professional organ player, von Drachenfels, and she comes to him and plays for him. And there's this sequence where he ends up keeping her copy of the organ sheet music and then returning it to Gideon Harlax later. And as he looks at this organ score, there are some symbols written in it, in what may be mathematical symbols or Greek letters, things of this type. It isn't clear exactly what they mean to begin with, and it's fairly clear that they aren't part of the music, so there's a series of clues that are related to that. There is an even stranger series of clues involving a typewriter. We early on saw Gideon Harlax very carefully using this IBM golf ball typewriter. This was the type of typewriter where you had a sphere that looked sort of like a golf ball that has letters on it, and the ball is rotated to different positions to stamp the paper while you use the typewriter. It was a state-of-the-art fancy machine at the time in the very early 80s. And you could use different balls in that, different golf balls, if you like, to get different sets of characters and different fonts and so on. And there was a series of things where we see the sets of symbols and we see the different golf balls and the catalog of the golf balls and the different symbols they can produce. And it becomes an involved little set of clues that comes from the design of that typewriter as well.
Yeah, as you say, it's quite interesting because it was obviously cutting edge state of the art at the time. And now it seems so strange and clunky. And, part of the setup here is that this is obviously before, personal computers. It's before mobile phones. Even Gideon Harlax's answer machine, which is part of the plot, is in itself a rather sort of clunky and ancient device to our eyes. But it's all there. It's all part of it. And there are all clues along the way.
The set of clues is quite complicated and involved. And at the same time, having this complicated set of clues and things, we also have references and homage to other films and things going on at the same time, which is why it becomes so involved and why there is, I would say, enough material to fill this 3-hour show.
Yeah, that's right. And Gideon, he brings it all together, or at least he seems to be, and we get the scene where he's finally starting to connect all the pieces of the puzzle. And this happens about halfway through the 3-hour film, and about the 90-minute mark, when he literally starts to draw lines on maps and start making complicated shapes on maps. And he seems to be bringing all these different elements together. And he has a revelation of what's going on, which leads to a quite literal cliffhanger, which is perhaps where they had intended to split the film. And then after that, things change direction somewhat, Brian, but we'll perhaps get to that in a moment.
Yes, they do go in a different direction at that point. However, as we go all through the film from beginning to end, we have, among other things, reference to the films of Alfred Hitchcock. In particular, we have a lot of references to Vertigo. We do have references to other films like Marnie, but there is a lot relating to Vertigo. The friend of Gideon Harlax, who is a film lecturer, gives a lecture on Vertigo at one point, and we see pencil sketches of a pivotal scene from Vertigo. As it turns out, behind the scenes, Vertigo at that time in the early 80s was under a licensing dispute, and it could not legally be screened anywhere, so they were not able to include film clips of Vertigo. So in fact, fact what the writer and director and perhaps producer did. They were able to find someone in the film industry who was located in Paris who actually had a 16mm copy of Vertigo that I think Alfred Hitchcock had actually given him. So they were able to go there to see Vertigo for use of making these references work, and at that point made these pencil sketches so they could have some reference to that pivotal sequence showing up in Artemis 81.
Yep, absolutely. Hitchcock is all over Artemis 81, and even to the point of having a very obvious Hitchcock blonde turn up at one point during his detective work, and Gideon encounters this female character in a library, and she's even credited in the credits as Hitchcock blonde, and she's a mysterious blonde woman who just appears for a short period of time and gives him a clue more or less and then moves on. And she was played by Ingrid Pitt, of all people, who, if you're of a certain age, you'll remember as the sort of queen of Hammer horror movies from the 70s. And she played Countess Dracula, but she's been in another number of other things. And she was even in Doctor Who, I think, twice for the third Doctor and with the fifth Doctor. I think she played sort of baddies in some of the Doctor Who episodes along the years as well.
But not Hitchcock blondes.
Not Hitchcock blondes in that. But she makes a memorable appearance, a very brief one. And talking of brief appearances, we also have to mention a blink and you'll miss it appearance by Daniel Day-Lewis, who was a very young actor at the time. It's probably one of his first roles. I think he'd been in one other thing on British TV before this, and he plays a student in the library who gives Gideon Harlech some clues about Artemis and fills him in with some background information on the Greek goddess.
That's right. There are some places where you occasionally see Daniel Day-Lewis listed as one of the stars of Artemis 81 just in order to have the name there. He was not. He had a total of something like 2 minutes of screen time.
Yeah, that's right. I think even on Amazon it lists his name first.
I think it might, yes. We also see Heleth, the Angel of Good, essentially falling to Earth or coming to Earth somehow and gradually becoming human. Or maybe he isn't quite human at the end. That isn't quite clear either. But there is that journey for him, which is an interesting character journey. And this Heleth, of course, was played by Sting and also one of his first roles. And it was an interesting portrayal in that it was someone who didn't have a lot of acting experience playing this role, and that was something that worked rather well. It was nice casting, I thought.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it is Sting. He looks like, you know, he looks like a rock star, and he's dressed all in white with his very blonde hair. Interesting choice for the part, and he, you know, he did some strange things with it, and he has that sort of otherworldly feel, I suppose, which helps him play this alien character.
That's right. And speaking of otherworldly, in the second half, the latter 90 minutes, we see a strange city that is like some type of unnamed European city where they speak a strange, incomprehensible language, and the city may have somehow been infected by evil, and it represents this mystery that both Heleth and Gideon Harlech are thrown into.
It's very strange. I mean, we had the first, as you say, the first half of this film, which, you know, despite the alien planet bits we've mentioned, is otherwise set in a Britain that we recognise. It's sort of like in modern times. And then halfway through, it jumps to this strange city, and this character, Gideon, is wandering around this strange city where he can't understand what people are saying to him. And there's all sorts of symbolic stuff going on. There's something terrible happening to the city. And then it seems to jump again, and he finds himself in a mysterious sort of underground military bunker where various people who've been connected to the suicides we've mentioned, so sort of like surviving family members of the suicides, seem to have now been held in this underground base where some form of mysterious experiments are being carried out. And it's, to be honest, it's all very strange and quite difficult to keep track of. The second half of the film is quite different to the first half of the film in tone, I think, Brian.
Yes, it is. The first half very much has this sort of investigation, not quite murder mystery, but mystery with a science fiction / supernatural / fantasy overtone to it. And then we get to the midpoint and we have, without getting into too much detail, we have a type of almost mystical rebirth for Gideon Harlax. And this strange communing with Healeth and this idea of this strange journey and the journey of growth that both Gideon and Healeth go through. And later we find that Gwen goes through it as well. And it isn't until sort of later on that we find characters like Gwen and Gideon sort of reclaiming their earlier identities and knowing who they were. So there's some complex stuff here. And I think in that latter half, we get a lot of those Danish impressionist film and Scandinavian film, Bergman. We get a lot of those types of influence in there, although the Hitchcock influence is certainly also there. And we have almost a third story, and that's the idea of Healeth and Azrael, the evil character, and Magog, who they refer to as Mother, who is this character who may cause great destruction, the three of them changing and affecting Earth. And that is the story that carries through from beginning to end in one way or another.
Just a hangar that closed behind us as we came. Barriers that open for us.
Not for us. For whom we bring.
Atrocity beneath. Above, this all we see. Burn them. Sink them.
Perhaps they'll suffocate. What use? There are more like those already in the world.
Yeah, it's got, as you say, it's got a three-act structure. The first act we can sort of recognise as reasonably straightforward. It's got some familiar sort of setting to it. And then the second and third act, there's a lot more complicated stuff going on, and it can be a little disconcerting when it changes from one to the other. But as you say, it's interesting stuff. And as you say, we have the force of evil, particularly with Azrael, who has cropped up as apparently as the butler to von Drachenfels, but he's obviously much more than that. He seems to be controlling the whole thing, or could we say orchestrating the whole thing, which is perhaps appropriate for all the musical themes that are going on in this movie.
Yes, the idea of Azrael and Healeth fighting over Magog and fighting over the Earth is sort of the central current here that influences everything. It doesn't take up the majority of the screen time in explicit ways, but it's what moves everything, and it becomes the central idea in the final segment of it near the end. Von Drachenfels is very prominent in the first half, and then near the end, he becomes prominent as well. And we get the connections between Von Drachenfels and Gideon Harlax and Gwen and Healeth and Azrael. They all start to become more clear as things progress.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to build to a climax, and the climax is going to answer some of these questions and show what was going on in the first part of the film and why some of the characters were doing the things that they were doing. So some of it does get explained, particularly as we build towards this rather impressive climax, which is going to have all sorts of the features that we've talked about, including the musical ones and very dramatic music.
Yes, the climax I found was very well done, and it was worth waiting for in most ways, for sure.
So we'll talk about a little bit more of the production stuff with some of our comments as we go along. We have mentioned in places the dialogue of Artemis 81. And I think we do have to say that, like many other parts of this film, the dialogue is rather strange in places. And perhaps, as you say, taking their influence from other sources, characters don't seem to actually be talking to each other. Instead, they seem to be delivering almost speeches or monologues in a form of blank prose, quite lengthy speeches where they seem to explain ideas and emotions, not necessarily the plot.
I think that well may relate to a lot of the Scandinavian film influences that we've talked about these philosophical ideas and having longer speeches that can explain things. I think in a lot of ways, British television in the early 1980s was the right place to do something like that, where you could have longer speeches and make them work, and you had actors with some theatrical experience who could pull that kind of thing off.
It does perhaps jar at first. It takes a little bit of getting used to the slightly weird way that characters speak when they're supposed to be having what we would think are normal conversations, and yet the way they talk is quite clearly somewhat unusual and strange.
It is a little odd, for sure. It has a bit of the, what sometimes called the heightened reality phenomenon, and this is used for Shakespeare a lot, where you're not having the characters speak or behave in a realistic way. They speak and behave in a heightened way, where everything is more vivid and more active and more detailed, and you get these sort of longer speeches and things like that.
And that perhaps also applies to the acting as well, because the ones, you know, the actors who have got these sort of heightened reality roles to play perhaps get the better deal in a way. I think, you know, like Roland Curran playing the force of evil Azrael quite enjoys himself being evil and nasty. And likewise, Dan O'Herlihy as the bizarrely named Von Drachenfels, this sort of weird musician with his flowing locks. That's quite a meaty role for him. I think some of the smaller, more ostensibly more ordinary roles are a bit more tricky, although Huel Bennett is really doing his best to try and bring all this together in the playing the writer Gideon at the center of it all.
I think most of the time he did do a fairly good job of it, but you get this type of situation where in this heightened and strange situation, the characters that are heightened and strange work very well. The ones that are a little more mundane don't always.
Yeah, I mean, it's tricky to see what the character of Gwen sees in the character of Gideon at the start of the film. He's not terribly likable, although he's solving the mystery for us. He's not a terribly likable character at the start of the film.
That's true, yeah. We also know, on getting back to the production side here, David Rose, the producer, as we mentioned, left after shooting was completed, and the young film editor that Rudkin wanted to use was not able to participate in the end. They felt that it had to be one of the more senior editors at the BBC had to take this on, and I don't know that the editor that did it had a great understanding of it. The editing may have been lacking in places with this, or it may have just been that it was awkward because they were filling to time.
Some parts just seem to drag, and other parts where you feel that you wanted to spend a little more time on what that particular clue or that particular item might mean, they seem to rush past them, whereas other bits are very slow. So it is slightly inconsistent along the way. And it has to be said, it's also rather strange in its use of music. There is obviously quite a bit of music because of this musical theme and the organist, but most of the music is only that occurs actually in the plot. So I think the term is diegetic music. It's just the music that the characters can hear, either when they're listening to something in their offices or when they're actually playing the organ with Von Drachenfels. So at other times, there's just long periods of silence with no background music at all, which is, again, quite unusual for British television and adds to this sort of strange atmosphere of the whole film.
Yes, I think the music that they did use worked very well, actually. And the music and lack of music gave the whole production a very stark sort of feel to it. It was quite bleak.
Yeah, it's strange. I mean, it certainly does look very bleak in places. And as we've said, some of the storyline, particularly the stuff that deals with suicide, is very grim and bleak. So I suppose it fits in. And they just play out with no musical accompaniment.
That's right. And in terms of starkness, we also have the signature effect scene for Artemis 81, which is the view of the alien planet with Magog in the middle, Helith on one side, Azrael on the other. It is done as a glass shot with the two suns in the sky and this very odd coloring, and it actually looks quite good. It gives it this sort of eerie feel, and I was pleased that they didn't overuse that. They used it at the beginning and sort of at the end, and in the middle they use it a little bit here and there, but they did not use it that much. And that was something that really worked well and added to this.
Yeah. I mean, it does work very well. As you say, it sets you off right at the start that there's something alien and strange going on. And it's quite a beautiful glass shot of these two suns on this planet, which sort of sink in the sky as we watch. So it looks great. It looks fantastic, that particular bit. Unfortunately, not all the effects look quite so good.
Well, yes, that wonderful alien planet shot could have held its own as a shot in, I think, in a major theatrical film from that time.
Yeah.
On the other hand, there's a scene with flocking birds that was called for that is rather disappointing. They animated the birds in old-style manual animation, and it looked like a cartoon of birds superimposed on the screen, and that was unfortunate. There were not many moments where you had sort of weak sequences like that. There were some things that they did elsewhere with lasers and fog, which are sort of dated looking, but relatively convincing. They worked reasonably well.
Yeah, it's the bird shot that's really terrible, and you'll spot it when it comes along. I mean, I presume they included it because it was another Hitchcock nod to the birds itself, but they don't really need it to be there. I mean, I think it's supposed to tell us that the characters are moving towards something bad and something terrible, but I think we know that already at that point in the plot. They could have left that shot out, really.
They probably could have. It did help with that sense of impending doom, and it was nice to see that their ambitions were not restrained, but in that case, it might have been nice for them just to go without that or do something slightly different.
I also have to note the one thing that I did spot as I was watching it, or rather hear as I was watching it, was that the sound effects man, or the Foley man, I think they're called, seems to have been given a new footsteps box for Christmas, because the footsteps of characters moving around are quite loud and echoey, and to me, they really sort of stood out.
Yes. That was, I'm guessing, aimed at this heightened reality effect.
Possibly, yes. Maybe that's what it is.
We're dealing with something that is, even if it's just the real world, it's something more than the real world. You may have noticed we're sort of segueing into our own thoughts about some of these things and what we thought of it, but let's do that in a bit more of a defined way. So, Eamon, what did you think was good and bad about this show?
Well, you can't criticize it for being short of ideas. There's loads of ideas going on in Artemis 81, almost too many for us to cover, as you've probably gathered. It jumps around and tries to cover all sorts of things, and there's about three or four different stories sort of crammed in there. So that's okay. It's certainly, it's a film of ideas.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. The ideas and the way that they were connected and layered worked very well. I thought, in addition, the sense of homage to the various Scandinavian films and to Hitchcock worked quite well. I liked how they did that, and I liked how they gave it this tone that was quite different from anything we're used to seeing in this kind of setting.
Yeah. I like the detective stuff. I thought that was quite good. I thought, it almost stood alone as a 90 minutes mystery, a TV detective show with him pulling all the clues together. And in fact, I think the audience are probably one step ahead of him. I think we're one step ahead of Gideon in working out what's going on. But I thought that stuff worked fairly well.
Yes, it was pretty good. It might have been even better if they had used the cliffhanger and split it into two parts at that 90-minute point. There is a spot that was designed as a cliffhanger, and they ended up doing it as one long show. I think in some ways it might have been more powerful as the two separate pieces.
It would have been the perfect point to split it in two. I presume they just ended up with their three-hour slot on BBC in late December and just had to go with it.
That's right.
The strange city, although it's difficult to understand what's going on there. It certainly looks impressive. This peculiar European city that's under some sort of curse or plague, which apparently was all shot in Birmingham and Liverpool. So they did that very well, and it looks creepy and weird, and I quite like the shooting there.
Not only was it in Birmingham and Liverpool, but the language they were speaking was, I believe, Estonian backwards. So they took lines and words in Estonian and spelled them out backwards, and that's what people were saying.
Backwards dialogue. It's almost like Twin Peaks. Come early.
Almost.
And then we've mentioned the good effect shots that we liked. You know, we love the glass shot. It looks great. So that stuff works very well. There was probably, I mean, there's probably other things that worked well for you, Brian.
I thought as a whole, the set of references and the way that they link things together with this very complex story, on the whole, it did work very well. The downside is that it was kind of hard to understand, especially on first viewing. You look at it and think, you know, well, what was this about? What am I seeing here? But I like the complexities in it. I find on repeated viewings, I've watched it a few times now, that it becomes an interesting piece with interesting ideas and character traits and character development that tend to blend in with the story. And a lot of things, it's quite obvious you see what are the story things and what are the character things. In this, they sort of blend together in a way that is quite nice. So I enjoyed that.
Okay. I mean, we've mentioned some of the bits that didn't work quite so well, including some of the effect shots and perhaps some of the acting. Were there any other bits that you found slightly more challenging or slightly less good?
Well, of course, one thing is having it in one long 3-hour show is unfortunate. I think that was a mistake, even though it was something they were on the production side, they were sort of pushed into.
It is too long, really, isn't it?
It is too long. That is probably the biggest negative. The other big negative is that in some ways it is a little too hard to follow. There are spots where it really is tricky to know what is going on. And the first half to the second half, it's a bit too much of a sharp left turn. These are all things that I liked. I liked the left turn in the story. I liked the complexity and that things were not obvious. But some of these things were just taken a little bit too far.
Yeah, absolutely. It does push itself as it goes along and perhaps pushes it a bit too far in places. And maybe the Hitchcock references and even the Gothic horror references, the sort of bringing in elements of Dracula towards the end, it all seems to be getting a bit too much.
Well, this is a script and a story that was very ambitious and very complex. And the big question in my mind for you, Eamon, and for the listeners, if they watch this, is it too complex and ambitious? And some people even use the word pretentious. I don't like the use of that word for films and TV shows. But is the script and story just too complex and ambitious?
It's a tricky one. I've now watched it 3 times, I think, once with the commentary and twice without. And certainly I think the first time I watched it, I didn't understand what was going on and I didn't really like what was going on. And it does improve with repeated viewings. It does become slightly easier to work out. I think for people who haven't seen it and who are wondering whether or not to try it, my advice would be that it's very much for people who want to try something slightly out of the ordinary. This is not the sort of typical stuff we're discussing on British Invaders. It's unusual. It's quite long. It wears its influences very proudly on its sleeve, and it's quite dense and hard to work out what's going on and what they're talking about in places. But if you're intrigued, if you're interested in Hitchcock, if you're interested in Bergman and sort of Swedish cinema, then maybe give it a try and watch it a couple of times. But I think, as we've hinted already, you might want to split up your viewing, I think, Brian.
Yes, I would agree with most of the things you said. To answer my own question, is the story and the script too complex and too ambitious? Well, yes and no. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. It does at times become sort of impenetrable. It's just too hard to see what's going on. There is not really a character or element to explain what's going on for us as we go. And I think it misses that a little bit. But on the whole, I think while they made a difficult program in some ways, I really respect what they did with it. And I think they got it about right in a lot of ways.
Okay, so you'd recommend it?
I would, yes. With, as you said, the conditions that this is a complex, challenging film. And if that's what you're interested in, or if you want to try something different, then absolutely, this is something to take a look at.
Okay. and maybe, you know, split it into two episodes of about 90 minutes long and watch it on two separate evenings.
Yes, I think that that makes a lot of sense. So that can stand as our recommendations that we both like this and sort of recommend it conditionally.
Okay.
Now, we mentioned earlier that our friend and listener, Mike, also known as Jarek, recommended this to us. So let's listen to what he had to say about it.
Hiya, Brian and Eamon. Mike from the UK here. A few weeks ago, I visited your Facebook page and read that you were going to cover Artemis 81 in an upcoming episode. So that prompted me to finally buy the DVD, despite it still being a little expensive for what it was. Anyhow, I watched the Region 2 DVD this afternoon in one sitting, just as I did way back when in 1981, when I watched it as a much younger guy, and went in cold with no research into the story again, just like the first time around. I only read more about the story after the fact, trying to make sure I could bring my own thoughts to the experience. I certainly understood it a lot better this time around, perhaps because the construction of the show is far more familiar in this age of TV production, and I was less hung up on the visuals, which at the time were very memorable. I was always a fan of Yul Brynner, so even after so many years, it's good to see him in something. Shelley hasn't been repeated in donkey's years. And by chance, you'll be covering Neverwhere, in which he plays a major role as well. And let's not forget Sting's first real acting effort. I've come away from the viewing experience quite satisfied and pleased. The story, which totally grabbed me nearly three decades ago, did so again, despite it being rather protracted, and, well, quite full of itself. But overall, it's held up very well. A pity the DVD has such poor picture quality. Or is it that large plasmas tend to enhance flaws in source material that a late 1970s CRT didn't? But the audio was fine, and it was presented in widescreen. The addition of a commentary track was pure gold. Only listened to the first half hour or so before recording this. Already it's proved itself worthwhile, as I was totally unaware the 81 in the title referred to the star and not the year. I'm sure your discussion of the show will also offer up gems of information, and hopefully encourage more listeners to grab a copy of Artemis 81, if only for curiosity's sake. Take care, guys.
So, availability.
Well, in Region 2, it was released on DVD in 2007, after 26 years in the wilderness, with people not being able to watch it and just being able to talk about it. It features a three-hour film. It features a commentary from the writer David Rudkin and the director Alistair Reed, which may or may not explain some of the mysteries of Artemis 81 as they go through. Apparently, the version on the DVD is slightly shorter than that originally broadcast by the BBC, which I gather is to do with the same Alfred Hitchcock film licensing problems that they originally had, and with some clips and stills from Hitchcock films which had to be removed.
Right, so probably not from Vertigo, but from other Hitchcock films. There was a sequence where you see a bunch of film posters and various things, so it probably related to that.
Yes, I think it's the bit with the film lecturer and his flat that we see, which is filled with film posters and stills and so on, so it must be to do with that. But anyway, it's available on Amazon, currently on at £9 for the DVD, and it's also available on the UK DVD rental sites, so you can get hold of it fairly easily in Region 2. Meanwhile, in Region 1...
Unfortunately, it's not available in Region 1. So if you're in North America, you'll have to get this as a Region 2 import if you want to see it. Also, we should mention that while there is some information about this given in the commentary on the DVD, there's some additional information at the writer's website, David Rudkin. That's www.davidrudkin.com. So there's some interesting things to take a look at there as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to track down information on Artemis 81, and some of the stuff we've been talking about is either from the commentary or from David Rudkin's own site.
That's right. So, in summary, Artemis 81 was a three-hour telefilm from 1981 that dealt with a battle between two alien characters who perhaps were angels on the side of light and on the side of dark. Those were Heloth and Azrael, and they were fighting over Magog, with Heloth trying to keep Magog asleep and Azrael trying to wake Magog to cause destruction, presumably on Earth. Meanwhile, on Earth, we have a long story involving the writer Gideon Harlax, along with Gwen, who may be his girlfriend, and Gideon is investigating a series of things that are happening that apparently seem to be related to the alien situation. And we have a quick left turn into a different story about a quasi-mystical rebirth for Gideon and a strange European city and an even stranger underground bunker. And Heloth and Azrael become even more involved, and we go towards a rather big conclusion that involves all of these characters along with organ music and a virtuosic organist called Von Drachenfels.
Very good. Well done, Brian. So next time, we're going to be back on slightly more solid ground, certainly for me. We're going to be talking about a program called Neverwhere, which was a six-part fantasy show, which came from the creative combination of Neil Gaiman and Lenny Henry. It's a fun show, and we'll be talking about that next time on British Invaders.
Yes, and that will put us squarely into the 1990s for that episode. You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you search for British Invaders on Facebook, you can find us there. So, thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yep, thank you very much. Do let us know what you think about Artemis 81, and this is Eamon from England saying goodbye.